For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, I'm going to be teaching you this afternoon a little bit about the so-called argument from reason, which basically argues that if God doesn't exist, you can't trust reason. Let's talk a little bit. I know I was first exposed to this in reading Francis Schaeffer's book, He Is There and He Is Not Silent, back in the early 70s. And he's got a chapter in there called The Epistemological Necessity, which I had to hit the dictionary to find out what that was even about. But as I chopped through that chapter very slowly with a lot of talks with my roommates, I was quite taken with it, because I had noticed, I had thought about this before when I was an unbeliever, when I was atheistic. One of the things that used to bother me from time to time was my own thought processes. I would sit there, you know, reflecting back at my life, thinking about the world, insight into the world, and just my own mind struck me intuitively that this doesn't fit very well with naturalism. Of course, I spent a lot of time as an atheist thinking about animal intelligence and comparisons with humans and other animals, and there were discontinuities there that bothered me as well. There were definitely moments of doubt that I remembered having as an unbeliever, because how do we get from a naturalistic process, matter, energy, physical law, to this kind of higher order thought? Very hard to see. Then C.S. Lewis wrote about it in the book Miracles. Those two authors actually took a slightly different direction, but a lot of overlap in what they were saying. As far back as John Calvin said in the Institutes, no man can survey himself without forthwith turning his thoughts toward the God in whom he lives and moves, because it's perfectly obvious that the endowments which we possess cannot possibly be from ourselves. David's thought that I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and that my soul knows right well. That's kind of at the heart of what we're observing in this particular argument. I guess I already talked about that. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a scientist either. My background's in history. I have more exposure to science than I do to philosophy. So I'm not speaking as a specialty or an expert in those fields, but I'm just trying to understand this from the standpoint of a communicator, really. And for expertise, I'm going to be referring to what the experts in those fields say. And I plan for an hour and a half workshop, and now they say it's only an hour and 15. So we're going to turn up the speed knob a little bit, see if we can get through this. I would also recommend you get up close enough that you can read along this. I'm going to do a lot of reading today. First off, we're not suggesting that people are necessarily reasonable or rational beings most of the time or always. The real question that we're asking ourselves is, how can we ever be rational? And if we are rational, how can we be confident that our rationality leads to truthful conclusions? If we have no basis, if we cannot account for how rational inference would work, then that means that any system we argue using reason is internally incoherent and self-contradictory. We're using reason to establish a position, even though we cannot account for why reason should be reliable. I'll talk a little bit about some of the sources I'm going to be referring to. I mentioned C.S. Lewis's Miracles and Schaeffer's He Is There and He's Not Silent. He also, Schaeffer's argument's a little different. He focuses on when you reason out from self, that there's nothing to ground your insight and everything becomes relativized to self, which is a slightly different point, but it's also very true. J.P. Moreland has a good chapter in his book, Scaling the Secular City. It's called The Argument from Mind. Victor Reppert has a new book out. He's a philosopher, and it's called C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea. It's a defense of this argument, the argument from reason. Pretty good book. Doug Grutice has a new tome out on apologetics, and his chapter on, cognition and the argument from mind in that. That's pretty good. I'll be quoting from that today. Alvin Plantinga's book, Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism, is largely a lot of that book is about this argument. Cornelius Van Til, an older, old school guy from the 30s and 40s, mostly 50s. He is the professor of apologetics at whatchamacallit seminary where Schaefer, he was Schaefer's professor in apologetics. That's what he got. He's the kind of the godfather of presuppositional apologetics, of which this whole argument naturally becomes a part of that. And that book is a classic on, he's kind of annoying because he puts he wraps it so much in a hyper-Calvinistic, you know, 5-point. To him, the enemies are, you know, the atheists, the Catholic, the Arminian, and then there's the Reformed, which are the good guys. So, but it's a good book. I'm also going to quote from my book, Discovering God. All right, and the secular sources, we're going to be talking about Thomas Nagel, who's a professor of philosophy at New York U, used to be at Berkeley. His book, Mind and Cosmos, is fascinating. He's still an atheist, or agnostic, but he admits that it's not adding up, and that naturalism and a reductive naturalistic explanation has completely failed to account for consciousness and reason. And I'll be quoting from him. Sam Harris's book recently out, Free Will. Here's a hard line physicalist who does not believe in free will, thinks it's completely imaginary. Michael Gazzaniga doesn't believe in it either. He's a mind science guy from Princeton, I think. Who's in charge, free will and the science of the brain, and tries to account for how we can explain higher order thought, even though there's no such thing as free will or consciousness, that they're imaginary. That's a piece of work. This Derek Penn source is from the scholarly journal on brain science and has to do with the difference between animal and human intelligence. Kristen Andrews' article, Animal Cognition, is in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Psychology, which you can get online free. Steven Anderson's book, Dr. Doolittle's Delusion, is about animal acquisition of language and the ape studies and all the things that have been used to try to bridge and show the similarity between humans and other animals, and he examines them in excruciating detail and dismisses them. David Berlinski is also an agnostic. His book, The Devil's Delusion, is actually referring to neo-Darwinism. He's got a real problem with the Darwinian account of things, and yet he has not bought into God. Leonid Perlovsky is a professor at Harvard in mind science and cognition. His book, Free Will and Advances in Cognitive Science, that's not a book, that's an article, which you can get free online if you Google that. What we're going to do today, first we're going to explain the argument from reason, what it is. We're going to look at a few of the major counterattacks that have been launched against it and assess those, and then we want to think about a few problems that we can acknowledge as theists that that are there and see if we can come up with some possible solutions to those. So let's start out with an explanation. Let's go right to Lewis in the book Miracles. He argues, first of all, that all possible knowledge depends on the validity of reason. Anyone, if we simply leap at something intuitively and we haven't reasoned our way there, then we have no way of knowing whether it's true or not. He shows that anyone that tries to establish something as true has to use rational arguments to establish it. Anyone who denies anything uses reason to deny it. Reason is undeniable. The only way you could deny the validity of reason is by using reason. And so it's a pretty tight argument there. Then he points out that under materialism, belief as a psychological event must be caused. So I come to believe something in my brain, and now I have a new belief. What caused that belief to come about? Under materialism, it must in fact be simply one link in a causal chain which stretches back to the beginning and forward to the end of time. How could such a trifle as lack of logical grounds prevent the beliefs occurring? Or how could the existence of grounds promote it? In the brain, we have, again, molecules, we have energy, and we have thermodynamics, we have valence, we have electromagnetic attraction. None of those have anything to do with rational grounding. They have to do with physics, a completely different category. He goes on to say, if an inferred conclusion were totally explicable from other sources, in other words, something caused me to think this, then it would cease to be knowledge. Just as, to use the sensory parallel, the ringing in my ears ceases to be what we mean by hearing if it can be fully explained from causes other than the outer world. If it isn't sound coming into my ears, but my ears are ringing for some other reason, then it's not really hearing. Well, I think you can see what he's talking about is if there is a cause and effect matrix, a causal matrix that's causing everything, then that's the materialistic view of life. It's all matter being affected by physics. Everything's being cause and effect. Our thoughts are included in that. And therefore, we don't really know whether they're telling us the truth. He says, but this, as it seems to me, is exactly what naturalism is bound to do. It offers what professes to be a full account of our mental behavior. But this account, on inspection, leaves no room for the acts of knowing or insight on which the whole value of our thinking as a means to truth depends. What does it mean to know something? Now, what does it mean to have insight under materialism? How does one piece of matter know another piece of matter? It's a real sore spot for naturalistic thinking. If the value of our reasoning is in doubt, you cannot try to establish it by reasoning. If by treating it as a mere phenomenon, you put yourself outside of it, then there's no way except by begging the question, you get back inside again. And so he's basically talking about the double talk of, on the one hand, explaining away cognition and reason as merely, you know, sparking molecules, but on the other hand, using reason and cognition to prove a point, such as naturalism. And so it's begging the question because you're assuming the very thing you just denied. The theist, on the other hand, that's us. Theism is the worldview underlying the Bible, denies that reason came by a process of selection which can select only the biologically useful. For theists, reason, the reason of God, is older than nature. And from it, the orderliness of nature, which alone enables us to know her, is derived. So this is a big difference between our worldview and naturalistic worldview. Naturalism has to show how reason developed in this in a natural selection scenario. And out of chaos and non-reason comes reason and order. A very high bar to clear. The theist, on the other hand, as he says, sees that reason is older than nature, was here before nature, that in fact the universe is inherently rational because it was created by a rational being. And therefore, rationality works in exploring that rational cosmos. This is what Craig was arguing last night. Why do numbers happen to correlate with the universe? That works out kind of nice. We can describe the universe numerically. The orderliness of nature, which enables us to know her. So I need order and ability to use my own mind to reflect on nature. I also need order out there, or why would I think that rational thinking would guide me into truth about a world that's utter chaos and without any order? I'm going to use an example from Discovering God here. Outside of our minds, rational analysis of our world only makes sense if we assume the world itself makes rational sense in the first place. How are we trying to make sense of something that makes no sense? There has to be an assumption that that we can discover a sense that's already out there. Here is a reflection on it by Albert Einstein. He said, this was in a journal article he wrote in the 30s. He says, the liberty of choice in applying new ideas in science. He's talking about kind of the philosophy of how science works in this article. And he says, the liberty of choice in applying new ideas, however, is of a special kind. It's not in any way similar to the liberty of a writer of fiction. Rather, it's similar to that of a man engaged in solving a well-designed word puzzle. He may, it's true, propose any word as a solution, but there's only one word which really solves the puzzle in all its forms. It is an outcome of faith that nature, as she is perceptible to our five senses, takes the character of such a well-formulated puzzle. And he says, of course, the successes reaped up to now by science do, it is true, give a certain encouragement for this faith. What's he saying? Let's think about a word, but he's talking about a crossword puzzle, all right? In this puzzle, we ask ourselves, to solve it, what do I need to believe? The first thing I need to believe is that it's a puzzle, right? If it's just ink marks on a paper randomly, I would never try to solve it. There'd be no reason to think there's anything to solve. And so, but if I address it and say, what if this is a word puzzle? What if I can put letters in here and make words and they'll line up? Now I can sit up and address it. Of course, if I think it is a word puzzle, then I must also think that somebody planned the word puzzle out, that there are right and wrong answers, right? That's implied in that assumption. Now, as I sit down and begin solving the puzzle, then that would confirm that my original one and two thesis were right. It is a word puzzle. I couldn't know that before. This was Einstein's point. It's kind of an act of faith to say, what if the universe makes sense? Let's plug some words in and see if they fit. And lo and behold, they do. You start to realize that that's confirming of that faith. This is all a big setup. Now, in the argument from reason, we can go further still. And that would be section 4. We're going to put a great big word right through the middle of this word puzzle. Personality. Personhood. What Schaefer calls the mannishness of man. And that is going to massively determine how the rest of that puzzle has to work. But we know the word belongs there because we have undeniable base line intuitive knowledge that I am me, that I am here, that I am perceiving reality, that I can think, that I have freedom of thought, nobody's making me think this, and that I'm an agent. All of these observations only consistent with personhood. Once that is plugged in there, that's going to eliminate millions of other possibilities, and it's going to determine how the rest of that puzzle goes. And it's got to go in. Yeah, my certain sense that I'm me, that I can see, that I can reason, that I'm making free decisions, that I'm a moral being, a creative being. These observations dictate how the rest of the puzzle works. If we can't believe these ultimately clear observations about our souls, we can't believe anything we perceive. Think about it. We're going to be called on by naturalists to say there's no such thing as a self. You're not even you. And I'm supposed to believe that? That would take overwhelming evidence to establish that, because apparently, if I'm even mistaken that I'm me and I'm here, then I'm mistaken about everything. How can I trust any of my conclusions or any of my observations at that point? Okay, back to Lewis. So this is what he's talking about, that there has to be an orderliness. Nature has to be set up in an orderly way, or else there's no reason to think that reason would unlock any part of it. He says also, for the theist, the human mind in the act of knowing is illuminated by the divine reason. It is set free in the measure required from the nexus of non-rational causation. So when I was talking about the laws of physics, this nexus of non-rational causation, gravity, magnetism, heat transfer, you know, and so forth, none of those are thinking things. None of those are logical things. Those are just forces, and yet they control the natural world. So we need something in here that is not under those laws in order for me to be able to think in a rational way. It is set free in the measure required. So I'm not that I'm totally free from the forces of physics, but I'm free enough. My mind is free enough. Free from this to be determined by the truth, now, by what I know and what I come to believe is truth, instead of what physics is making me think. And the preliminary process within nature which led up to this liberation, if there were any, were designed to do so. That's another part of we do think that the situation's been set up, including our brains, but that's also been designed by God so that we're able to think. Here's what Doug Grutius is how he pronounces it, says in his book. He says, in a world where, if the world were made only of material things arranged in various causal patterns, then our thoughts would not be exempt from that causal matrix. See, how can we argue that I'm thinking about what's really true if my thoughts are just as determined as everything else in the world? The notion that our minds, with our minds, we can transcend material forces and discover the truth about reality would therefore be unwarranted under naturalistic thinking. When we reason from a premise to a conclusion, we're not thinking in terms of material causes, but rather in terms of rational inference. And the laws of rational inference are different than the laws of physics. In fact, they are completely different categories. They have nothing to do with each other. Rational inference. Let's think about this a little bit more. Okay, so here we have a mechanical watch. And I picked this because you can see the little wheels locked into the other teeth of the other wheels. Of course, the tension on the spring gradually being played out by the rocker arm and so forth. This system is determined by physics, all right? You have matter, you have energy stored in the spring, and you have connectedness that has been designed to run a certain way. This watch cannot think, okay? It does exactly what the laws of physics dictate that it do. And really, a computer is no different than this, even though it's different in quantity, but it's the same. In fact, I brought a picture of an early mechanical computer This is the fire control computer on the Arizona-class battleship. So this is World War II. Before they had transistors, computers were made with gears. They were big calculation machines. Incredibly complex. I've studied one of these. You can tour one down at Holden Beach, and they have little windows where you can look through. There are thousands of wheels and gears inside of these things, and you put in all these different variables: wind speed, my direction, his direction, my speed, his speed, our distance, and the charge that I want to throw, and everything else. And you crank these with these little crank wheels. You crank those things in, and what are there? About 50 different things that you can crank in there, and finally all of these gears mesh together, and finally it comes out and says, shoot this. Put this much powder in, and put it at this degree, and this declension, fire. And they hit the other ship. It works. It's a computer. But see, today computers are kind of mysterious to us because it's a little microchip there, and there's supposed to be billions of transistors on there. But really, a transistor just is like switch this way or that. That's all a transistor does. It's an electronic switch. And by stringing them together, we can organize them to accomplish logical tasks. But the fact of the matter is, a computer is an extension of the human mind. And we have created computers, but they cannot think especially in the way that we're talking about today. We're going to be focusing on higher order thought as opposed to primary or first level thought. The act of knowing, the act not of remembering that something was so in the past, but of seeing that it must be true always and in any possible world. Lewis talks about how animal intelligence, like if they fell through the ice at one time, they'll remember that and avoid thin ice after that. They can learn. That's primary level thinking. Whereas this idea of seeing in the sense of the laws of rationality, for example, if A equals B and B equals C, then A must equal C. A child would be able to see that. Animals cannot. And it is, so even at this level, this is a simple example of deductive inference. Inductive inference here as well, which we could call inference to the best explanation, is when we look out at a situation and we come up with multiple different possible reasons, explanations for it. And we weigh those explanations against the evidence to see which one is the most likely answer. That is higher order thinking. Lewis says, reasonable thoughts are connected with the nature in a different way. As the understanding of machine is certainly connected with the machine, but not in the way the parts of the machine are connected with each other. The knowledge of a thing is not one of the thing's parts. In this sense, something beyond nature operates whenever we reason. It's really the mind-body duality, dualism. What we're seeing here is that, yes, I have a body with a brain that works in a certain way, but there must be something else. If I think reason's valid, that implies that there's also a mind that governs the material. He also says reason can be guided, like one man's reason can be led to see things by the aid of another man's reason. It's only when we're asked to believe that reason came from non-reason that you must cry halt, for if you don't, all is discredited. You've lost the concept of what it means to know, what it means to have insight at that point. You're back to this, saying that my mind is like this watch and it gave me knowledge. Those thoughts are incompatible, absolutely incompatible. Moreland, J.P. Moreland, in Scaling the Secular City, gives five things that need to be true before we can be rational agents. First, minds must have intentionality, intent. What does it mean to intend something? Not to be compelled by nature to do something, but to decide that I want to do this, capable of having thoughts about or of the world. So it's not that I'm part of that gear mesh and I'm one of the wheels in there, but rather that I'm standing back and looking at the picture as a whole, at nature, the world, and having thoughts about it. Secondly, reasons, propositions, thoughts, laws of logic, and evidence and truth must exist. I'm not sure I follow that one. I'm not sure that's even true. Three, one must be able to see or have rational insight into the flow of the argument and be influenced by this act of perception informing our beliefs. Yeah, that's exactly what reasoning is. We send the jury into the back room and they say, start your deliberations. They're going to deliberate. What does that mean? It means they're going to examine this case that's been put, the evidence, they're going to weigh it, they're going to debate it, and they're going to come to a conclusion. To think that they're going to do that and that they're able to do that implies that they have a position outside of the subject where they can analyze and weigh that evidence. It definitely implies this rational insight that they have. Fourth, we need a stable self to do the reasoning. Who is deciding these conclusions? If I'm thinking about something and reaching a conclusion, who's thinking? What is thinking? If I'm a part of, there has to be a self that can add up my thoughts from yesterday to my thoughts today, that can accumulate knowledge and insight, and it's me. Even though my body maybe has completely changed out all of its molecules from what I used to be 40 years ago, I'm a completely different material entity, but it's still me. I remember everything that happened back then. It was me then, it's still me today. That's necessary in order to be able to reach rational conclusions. The fifth one, he says, is that you have to have an agent view of the self, where I am a self and I can do stuff. Under that, he says, I have to be able to deliberate, to reflect about what I'm going to do. I have to have free will. Oh, yeah. Free will is necessary in order to trust reason. And it's illuminating to see that most mind scientists do not believe in free will. Now, think about that. If naturalists do not believe in free will, how can they say then that I'm freely arriving at valid, rational conclusions? Since I'm not really reaching them through rational means, I am compelled to reach whatever outcome I reach. He's right. Free will is necessary. I have to be the origin of my acts. I'm not being made to do this. I'm deciding to do it. Free will, he says, is incompatible with physical determinism. The belief that everything is a cause and effect chain of matter and energy, physical law, you cannot get free will out of that, period. If you're going to bring in a free will concept, you just left naturalism at that point. Even though they do it, some of them. I'm going to quote from a couple of guys who are like naturalists, but they're like, yeah, but we believe in free will. For a belief to be rational, when I must be able to deliberate about whether or not I accept it, and I have to be free to choose it, and I must enter into the process as a genuine agent and not as a marionette, Gassaniga and, Sam Smith's books both have guys with marionette strings going to their brain. That's their view. So that's not reason at that point. Here's Leonid Polovsky, the professor from Harvard Mind Science. He says, most contemporary philosophers and scientists do not believe that free will exists. The reconciliation of scientific causality and free will remains an unsolved problem. And it will remain unsolved forever because those are logically incompatible. They're contradictory concepts. He says, let me repeat the fact that most scientists do not believe in free will. Perlosky does. He himself is an atheist. He says, you know, materialistic monism is the only way to go. And yet he says, we don't know how we can have free will and scientific causality. But then he says, oh, we do have free will. We have to. And he sees how it will dismantle society. It will dismantle morality. We couldn't hold anyone responsible for anything. The whole legal system would have to be done away. And that it would dismantle our ability to think rationally. He sees all those things. So as a result, he says, free will definitely exists. We just don't know how it can. And we're working on it. Well, they're going to be working for a long time if they think that cause and effect and a natural cause and effect in a closed system is ever going to lead to freedom. The pieces just aren't there. Now, while we're dismissing the claims of naturalism, we should maybe take a minute here on pantheism as well, because Grutius shows why pantheism can't account for reason either. And Victor Reppert's book erred on this. He said that pantheism, I think he's wrong, I think Grutius is right. He says on this worldview, pantheism, the belief that God is everything, that everything is God. On this worldview, mind is explained in terms of a universal mind or consciousness that encompasses all of reality. Pantheism cannot explain the existence of matter. In fact, in most pantheistic scenarios, the material world is illusion. It's not really even here. And pantheists cannot explain our finite consciousness, since it claims that only one infinite consciousness exists. The saying, Atman is Brahman, means the individual is the all. The belief that you're an individual, separate being is false. That is unenlightened thinking. And when we get to moksha, when we get to nirvana, the drop of water enters the ocean and becomes once again the all. And everything before that, thinking that you're a separate consciousness, is delusion. They also explicitly reject reason as a guide to truth. In Eastern religion, you have to transcend rational categories in order to apprehend God. And so, as Grutius puts it, if pantheism is true, we cannot trust our rational faculties because A, they're not designed to know the world. B, there is no finite material world to know. It's not even there. And C, reason is not the organ to discern truth. So, I mean, he's completely right. So, naturalism, no basis for rationality. Pantheism, no basis for rationality. And so, what does that leave us with? Materialism, pantheism, theological dualism, the belief that there's an equal and opposite good and evil deity. Theism, that's us, belief in an infinite personal God, or deism, the belief that a creator God exists, but history is gone, he's not around, doesn't care, doesn't speak. The silent God. Well, we've seen that materialism can't account for rationality. Pantheism can't account for it either. Maybe any one of the last three could, although hardly anyone is a theological dualist these days. This worldview has basically disappeared from the earth. And deism is pretty rare too, because both of them have a lot of internal problems that we don't have time to get into. Anyway, that's about all I'm going to say as far as I hope you're tracking with me enough to see the trend of this argument, what it is. Now, what does the non-Christian world throw back against this charge? Basically, our counterattacks come in a few basic areas. Reductionism is the idea that by analyzing something and breaking it down to its pieces, to the most minute pieces, and then reassembling it again, you gain understanding of it. And so in the case of reductionism applied to this area, the reductionist naturalists try to reduce thinking and rational thought down to its pieces and parts, and show that when we understand the pieces and parts, then we have explained how thought works, how rational thought works. We also have a counterattack from double talk, gobbledygook. Talk about that in a minute. Animal intelligence is another area that's thrown up, and quantum physics. So we're going to go through each of these real quick. On reductionism, I was arguing with an atheist about consciousness a few months back, and he said, we basically understand most of the brain's operation and how neurons work and how the synapse of the neurons works. So we basically are there we're getting there on understanding the brain. And, you know, my reply is, well, we understand even more about how my car works. We can explain every piece on that car. The question is, who's driving it? It's not that I can show how a brake works. I mean, that's not explaining anything. Or think of this illustration. So we get some chemists, and they come and study, you know, paper with ink on it. We do the chemistry of ink. We do the chemistry of the paper. We show how the fibers in the paper reflect light, and it's been bleached. We can show that ink absorbs light. And we can see that the resins in it make it adhere onto the paper and so forth. And so we've got it broken down. We've basically explained pretty much everything there is to know about ink and paper. And so then here we have now explained this Shakespeare play, how it came to be. Because we've explained how ink works and how paper works. And that's what it is. It's ink and paper. Okay. No, you have not explained anything, really. We're not interested in the first place in how ink, why ink doesn't absorb or absorbs light. And in fact, you haven't even come one step closer to explaining it. What you've done is completely missed the point. What is it we need to explain? Not how light is working on the text of the play. It's the genius of the play, it's the story, it's the content, and the creativity that went into that, which has nothing to do with ink or paper. And so I think this is actually a pretty good picture of what physical reductionism does, materialistic reductionism does with the human mind. Yes. That's fine. Yes, we can explain how chemicals behave at the nerve synapse, but is that telling us anything about even what a thought is, let alone an insight, let alone my ability to reach rational inference when it comes to the world? Nagel, Thomas Nagel, a non-believer, professor of philosophy, in his article, What is it like to be a bat? Says, any reductionist program has to be based on an analysis of what is to be reduced. If the analysis leaves something out, then the problem's going to be falsely posed. That's basically what that paper and ink, you know, illustration does. Yeah, they explained paper and ink and stuff, but they left out, wait, it's the creative writing of the story and of the play, which have nothing to do with those categories. So, of course, you're going to get a superficial answer at that point. Grutai says, a rock is not loving. A bed is not hateful. Mental states and physical states differ in kind, not in degree. Thus, they cannot be identical. Given this very simple principle of identity, whatever differs in kind cannot be identical. True. Inescapable. So here we are studying brain activity, which is one kind of thing, when we're supposed to be thinking about mental states, which is a different kind of thing. He goes on to point out there is no graduated spectrum of states between the mental and the physical. They're just two different dimensions. They don't intersect. You can't go halfway mental and half physical. One is one category, one is the other category. So this is a category mistake to think that analyzing how the human brain works tells us that we now understand mental states. Moreland says sentences may be made of black ink. They may be on a page. They may be 4 inches long. But it's hard to see how the content of the sentence, that is the proposition, the thought expressed by the sentence, could be on the page. Such entities seem to be non-physical entities which can be in the mind. Yeah, your thoughts, the proposition. It's not a material entity at all. Daniel Dennett's book, Consciousness Explained, he's a reductionist. He doesn't believe in free will. He doesn't believe there's a mind. He thinks that it's all juice. Solids and liquids, that's it. And as they point out, his reductionism has led detractors to nickname his book Consciousness Ignored and Consciousness Explained Away, which is basically what happens under this reductionist approach. It is a complete swing and a miss. And if you ever listen to any Dennett's lectures, a bunch of them are on YouTube and stuff, it's so superficial. He puts up pictures and shows that it took someone several hundred milliseconds to recognize a difference in this picture. And that's supposed to tell us what? It's like, you know, they operate at such a primordial level. They're nowhere near addressing the real issues when it comes to rationality. The other thing we get is basically, in my opinion, double talk. When we start talking about epiphenomenalism or emergent properties, several different, you know, fancy sounding words that have been coined to explain how the brain is all there is and the brain is material, and yet there's this epiphenomenon or this emergent property of a brain at a certain stage of development is a mind. And we're saying, so is it non-material then? And we're talking about matter giving rise, having emergent properties that are non-material. No, they're still material. So it's very double talk. It's frankly, it's putting a name on it, doesn't explain anything. And I think it's like the matador's cape steering the charging bull away. By throwing out some big words. If you can understand it, good luck. I have knocked myself out reading about it, and I swear I just think they're absolutely prevaricating. Emergent entities or properties, substances arise out of fundamental entities and yet are novel or irreducible with respect to them. For example, it's sometimes said that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain. That's the Stanford Encyclopedia of Psychology. You can read a whole, 20-page article on it. Completely insane. I'm sorry. That's about all I have to say about that. Let's go to animal intelligence. Animal intelligence is thrown up as a defeater for this thesis. And largely because, although some people believe in animal minds and even animal souls, and we heard J.P. Moreland saying he believes that animals have souls when he was here last year, I don't buy into that. I think that it could be a defeater if we can show that the same kind of rational inference that we're drawing is observable in animals all the way down the line, and maybe dropping off when we get down to reptiles or fish. I think it would really throw into doubt this proposition, because Lewis, in his original argument, says the theist thinks that our rationality came from God's rationality, that he imbued us with this, and so it's linked to that text about how God said, let us make man in our image, male and female, he made them in his image, he made them to be made in the image of God. There should be a difference. And so this line of argument takes direct aim specifically at biblical theism and its belief that humans are created in the image of God. Berlinski quotes Nature, the famous scientific journal, in an editorial saying, "The idea that human minds are the product of evolution is an unassailable fact." And they go on, with all deference to the sensibilities of religious people, "The idea that man was created in the image of God can surely be put aside." Now, that's the kind of stone wall dogmatism that we're up against in this area. He quotes Franz de Waal as saying, "If an extraterrestrial were to visit Earth, he would have a hard time seeing most of the differences we treasure between ourselves and the apes." You know, like, there is some difference in quantity. This started with Darwin, who spent the last years of his life trying to show that animal and human intelligence were pretty much a difference in quantity, not qualitatively different. I think that people who argue this have very weak powers of perception. I've always thought that. You know, you're sitting and watching one of these specials, and they're talking about how the chimp is virtually human in intelligence. And you're sitting there like, you know, we're sitting here talking about this. I'm watching this on a television. A chimp poking a hole with a stick to get some grubs out. No, they're not the same. They're not even close. I don't know how anyone could be so blind to think that there isn't that much difference there. But anyway, I've gotten into reading on this. I want to share some of the problems that I'm seeing with these arguments. First of all, when you read about animal consciousness, the word consciousness is stretched like a rubber band to include almost everything. You know, you can use the word, like you could use the word consciousness to be the difference between, like, when I'm asleep, I'm not conscious, and when I wake up, I'm conscious. So consciousness could mean as little as realizing there's a dresser in my room, which I didn't realize when I was asleep a few minutes ago, but now I see it and I'm like, I know where I am. Okay, so if we think of consciousness in that level, that's not really what we're talking about here. Perception, simple awareness of our surroundings, reactions to things. We are focused in this talk, we're talking about higher order thought and higher order consciousness. Let's imagine here we have a single cell organism on the left, humans on the right. We can fill in a few species. Of course, there would be many thousands more. But some different levels that are roughly probably ascending in order of complexity. So if we come with this idea of simple perception or awareness of my surroundings, that's going to go almost down to the single cell level. I mean, protozoans can sense their surroundings with their cilia, and that's how they feed. Planaria can move toward light and retreat. It's not really what we're interested in here. There's also hardwired intention, where the deer sees the lion and runs. There is no, what would be the best, you know, thing to do right now? If you step on a dog's tail and he barks and bites at you, he's not thinking about that. That's raw reaction, and it's hardwired into the animals. That goes pretty far up the continuum. Adaptive intention, where you analyze the situation and try different things, find the most adaptive thing, is really only found among pretty high in the animal order, mammals mainly, and perhaps, yes, yeah, some of the smartest are birds, scrub jays, rooks, crows. Simple pattern recognition. The lion notices that the deer always seem to go to the river down this pathway. The next day, he's out by the pathway waiting for. He recognized there's a pattern here. Yeah, we see this. It's basically mammals and some high-order birds. Some of the birds are very smart. Group hunting. not just that we hunt in a group, but that we use group hunting tactics. So fish might hunt in a school, but I'm talking about group hunting where the lions split up, we'll go wait for them while you chase them into us, that kind of thing. Pretty far up, higher level mammals mostly, and a couple of birds. Yeah, Harris hawks hunt as a family groups. Emotions, clearly evident, down, but I would say most, a lot of mammals probably. You know, you see that your dog is happy when you get home from vacation. Emotions is not what we're looking at here. Now, when we start to think about abstraction, that means that we're not just talking about this object that I see in front of me, a concrete object, this book, but we're starting to talk about books as an abstract category, all different types of books, and we understand that abstract collection of things. That's human only. No animal can do that. When we talk about recognizing truth, that is human. When we talk about second order thinking, thinking about my thoughts, reflecting on this pattern of thinking I've been undergoing, that is human only. When we talk about self-awareness, that I know who I am relative to other selves as well, that is human. So it is this part here that we're calling higher order thought or higher order consciousness. That's what we're interested in. Of course, we can put in rationality, morality, spirituality, artistic creativity, syntax and language, and dozens of other things also exclusively fit in that circle. And this is what we're referring to when we talk about, so to say that animals have a soul just like me because they're aware of their surroundings. What is that real? Again, it's a category error. Now, literature reveals constant efforts to lower the definition of mind to where it will include animal minds. Kristen Andrews writes, though philosophers and psychologists seem to generally accept that other species have minds, there's widespread disagreement about what that means. For some, it merely means that some species can feel pain and so are conscious beings, or that some species are rational agents who have reasons for an action. So again, definitions, very important in understanding the distinctions here. What do we mean? It's better to adopt something like higher order thought to distinguish ourselves from simply the thought that, ow, that burned, I'm not going to touch it again. Which obviously, at that level of lower primordial thought. Anthropomorphism, though, is when researchers read humanness into animals with their imagination. This is the article I referred to, Derek Penn, Keith Holyoke, Daniel Povolini. I'll just call it Penn et al. These are researchers in writing in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, Darwin's Mistake, explaining the discontinuity between human and non-human minds. They say, and these guys, by the way, are all naturalists. None of them are theists. They're just strictly looking at it from a scientific point of view. They say Darwin downplayed the differences between animals and humans as one of degree and not of kind. Pepperberg says for over 35 years, researchers have been demonstrating through tests, both in the field and in the laboratory, that the capacities for non-humans and animals to solve complex problems form a continuum with those of humans. It's just pretty much a gradual upward slide. These guys think all of this is flat wrong, no evidence behind it. They say the functional discontinuity between humans and non-human minds pervades nearly every domain of cognition, thought, and runs much deeper than even the spectacular scaffolding provided by language or culture alone can explain. Only humans form general categories based on structural rather than perceptual criteria. Animals can sort blocks into the green ones and the red ones, but it has to be perceptual. It has to be something concrete right in front of them. humans can also separate things by structural, functional bases that don't look the same at all. Only humans find analogies between perceptually disparate relations. I'll explain some of this more later. Only humans draw inferences based on the hierarchical or logical relation between relations, thinking about thoughts relative to other thoughts, concepts relative to other concepts. Only humans cognize the abstract functional role played by constituents in a relation as distinct from the constituents' perceptual characteristics. Only humans postulate relations involving unobservable causes. So humans can see something happen and estimate that there must be a cause that's not visible here. Animals are incapable, for example, mental states, hypothetical physical forces, gravity, the discovery of gravity. That's a human thing. Animals would never discover something like that because it's not visible. They argue there is not simply a consistent absence of evidence for any of these high-order relational operations in non-human animals. There is compelling evidence of absence. If you know the saying that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, yeah, that could be an argument from silence, but they're saying, no, it's not that. It's both. They say that their colleagues already previously proposed that humans alone are able to reinterpret the world in terms of unobservable, hypothetical entities. Humans not only recognize when two physical stimuli are perceptually similar, the similar colored blocks, they can also recognize that two ideas, two mental states, two grammatical constructions, two causal logical relations are similar as well. Even preschool children understand that the relation between a bird and its nest is similar to the relation between a dog and a doghouse, despite the fact that there's little surface or object similarity. They don't look alike. It's the concept that the bird lives in the nest, the dog lives in the house. And so a three-year-old child can perceive that similarity, but no animal can be taught to do that. The propensity to evaluate the similarity between states of affairs based on causal, logical, and structural characteristics of the underlying relations rather than on their shared perceptual, visual features appears quite early and spontaneously in all normal humans, as early as 2 to 5 years of age. Yeah, I've actually been noticing this. I've got a grandchild named Max that's just over a year who recently learned the idea of clock. So in the last few weeks, he's been going around pointing at things, clock. He points to the grandfather clock. He points to a gold clock. He points to the watch, clock, clock, clock. He's showing already something that no animal is capable of. It's not that these things look alike. It's that he understands their clocks. My other grandchild, when he was between 1 and 2, came up with the concept of the gook. A gook is an object with buttons on it, that's usually technology. Either toys with buttons, a keyboard's a gook, phones, gooks, watch with a light button is a gook. And so, it was real funny to watch him identify all these things as gooks. The theory that he got that ability because of language doesn't seem to hold up because none of the rest of us knew what a gook was. We figured it out from him. But yeah, basically, and so we're talking about at 1 year old doing this. No, they're not similar. Penn says, analogical reasoning is a fundamental and ubiquitous, that means commonplace, aspect of human thought. Humans are operate under rules. They're able to understand rules that operate. It's a hallmark of human cognition is our ability to freely generalize abstract relational operations to novel cases beyond the scope in which the relation was originally learned, which is an essential pathway to language. I can learn a rule here, and then I get in a different situation, and I realize that rule applies in this different situation. It is role-based algebraic rules, as Marcus points out, that are the hallmarks of human thought and language. To date, there is no evidence for this kind of rule learning in any non-human animal. By the age of 3, all normal humans are able to reason about higher-order relation between small-scale artificial spatial models and large-scale spatial relations in the real world, like a map. So we can look at a map and realize this is telling me about the streets out here. Or a diagram. We could show a kid, a preschool kid. This is how volcanoes work. As the magma comes up out of there, and then it shoots out of the top and goes boom. We could explain that to a kid, and they would get it. No animal would ever be able to understand that diagram. How similar is human and animal intelligence then? Transitive inference is another area. If you're told that Bill is taller than Charles and Abe is taller than Bill, human children can infer that Abe's taller than Charles, of course. They don't have to be given any information about how tall is each one. Just the fact that they have that relation to each other, they're able to infer the necessary, what Lewis said, that it's true in all situations. The available comparative evidence suggests that there is a critical and qualitative difference between the ways that humans and non-human animals reason about causal relations. Only human animals can reason about a higher order relations in a structurally, semantic, and inferentially productive fashion, reasonable. At the same time, we have acknowledged from the outset that this cognitive gap must have evolved largely through incremental Darwinian processes. So they're not giving up on that at all. They're totally committed to Darwinian process. But they're saying, let's face the facts. They give this list of things: reasoning in terms of unobserved or hidden causes, distinguishing between genuine and spurious causes, reasoning diagnostically from effects to their possible causes, planning their own interventions in a quasi-experimental fashion to elucidate ambiguous causal relations, figuring out which is the true cause by an experiment, judge and discern novel relations by a process akin to analogical inference. They say that in stark contrast to the human case, there is no compelling evidence that non-human animals do any of these things. I just listed them all out again, so I shorten it. Indeed, there is consistent evidence of an absence across a variety of protocols. This case is open, this case is shut. And all of the claims about the similarity between humans and non-humans, gross, gross exaggeration, and dishonesty too. Theory of mind, this is the ability to recognize that I have a mind, but also that others have minds, and then to reason about other people's minds in a theoretical way, like I bet if this happens, he'll think that. If this happens, he'll be angry. If this happens, she'll be jealous. Only humans can do that. They say that non-human animals do not appear to have anything remotely resembling a theory of mind. And they also dismissed a widespread argument that you'll hear if you read in this, which is that it's language that explains why humans, because we got language, that's what rewired our mind and made us able to think at these high orders. They don't buy that either. They argue that we don't think language alone is sufficient to account for the discontinuity between human and non-human animals. There's compelling evidence that the human mind is distinctively human, even in the absence of normal, natural language sentences. They give the example of late-signing deaf children. So these are deaf children. They've never heard a sentence. And they're neglected, so they're not taught how to do sign language when they're young. Now they're up to, you know, early teen years. They've never been taught to sign. And as they point out, they may not be normal. It is a barrier to their learning because language is one of our big channels for gaining access to information. So these kids will be behind normal kids. But, as they point out, they nevertheless manifest grammatical, logical, and causal reasoning abilities far beyond those of any non-human subject. They're still essentially human. The gulf, there's a little gulf between them and other kids, a huge one between them and animals. They even point out the cases where kids that haven't been taught to sign make up their own sign language, thus proving it's not because of the language that we have the intellect, it's the other way around. Oh, they point out that even after decades of exhaustive training, they've never been able to train an animal to talk. This Stephen Anderson from Yale goes through the deceiving, fakey stuff, like the, remember Coco? You old enough to remember back to the 80s? That was the presented as the ape who really learns sign language and who uses it the way humans do, swearing, using metaphors, telling jokes, making puns. I remember watching National Geographic on this. All of it carefully edited, and the, you know, the researcher there saying, oh, he just said this. He says, but make no mistake, we have nothing but Patterson's word for any of this. She has not produced anything for anyone to look at except her own written summaries. And he goes through all of the ape experiences trying to teach chimps, gorillas, bonobos to talk. Utterly failed. None of them, they could get up to where they have 150 symbols so that this is the symbol, you push a button, this key for a banana. But what is missing is syntax, which is where we arrange words, and it's the arrangement that enables us to have unlimited, infinite meanings. So you can hear a sentence from me that you've never heard before, and you immediately know what it means. No other animal can do that. Simply recognizing and linking up symbols, particularly when you're imitating the behavior of the researcher, that's just a totally different kind of category. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead. I could have sworn we had an hour and a half to do this. He says, we find that non-humans reason solely in terms of first-order perceptual relationships. They're real good at that. But that's as far as it goes. I even included some of their professional critics who were saying, finally, somebody's willing to spit this out, and it's really true. So that leaves us one last thing, which is sometimes, as Berlinski talks about Christopher Hitchens, who was inept and didn't understand science or math, would wave quantum physics like a majestic frond as the explanation of all things mental. I just can make a couple of simple points about it. First of all, quantum physics shows randomness and uncertainty that is not freedom of choice. Freedom of choice requires intent, and random movement of subatomic particles is not intent. The effort is, by studying quantum physics, the uncertainty principle is supposed to show that we're not like the gears in that watch, completely determined, but there's something undetermined in the universe when we look at quanta. Of course, according to some interpretations, it's really only an inability, it's measuring an inability on our part to perceive the locations of subatomic particles. Others interpret it to be, you know, really things coming into existence for no reason, radical interpretations of the theory. Still, though, the problem is that the thoughts of in the brain, the mechanisms of the brain, are not subatomic. Quantum theory doesn't apply to regular molecules and above. It only applies to subatomic particles. And so it seems completely irrelevant to this whole discussion. Well, there are some theistic problems that we could have thought through if we had a little bit more time. Nothing that big. Let's skip this part. Perlosky, in another part in his article, says physical biology has explained the molecular foundations of life, DNA, and proteins. Cognitive science has explained many mental processes in terms of material processes in the brain. Yet, cognitive science is only approaching some of the foundations of perception and simplest actions. We have no idea of nearly 99% of our mind's functioning. And there is the truth. It's good to hear it from a naturalist, because the naturalistic claim that we're closing in on brain operation, we pretty much got it, is so false, it's just hard to exaggerate. And Perlosky is telling the truth. 99%, we have no idea. I'll part on this note. Inference to the best explanation is when you look at a set of variables like this, and considering all things, you decide the best inference, the best explanation for this is it's a sandcastle created by human beings. And we've got various data to kind of back that up. We've seen this type of pattern, not the exact same thing, not that particular sandcastle, but we've seen other things, and we're basically going to say, I think humans made this. Now, the opposition then could come back and say, oh, but where did those humans come from? If you're just going to say it's humans, then how did humans become rational and able to do this kind of thing? Who made them? Who are they? I don't know. We don't need to know any of those answers, but this is where naturalists, will show the universe must have been made by a god, and they'll be, oh, well, who made God? Well, where did he come from? In the nature of adequate explanatory force, we don't have to always explain the thing that explains this thing. That leads to an infinite regress where you can always say, oh, yeah, but where did that come from? Oh, yeah, well, where did that come from? And the fact is, we don't know who these humans are, and we don't know where they went or where they came from. We don't need to know that. It's still the best explanation. And so we have the best explanation for our rational minds and for the gross, massive disparity between humans and even the most brilliant animals, which is special creation by God, creation in the image of God. And I think we can use this to build people up. One of the uses for it is for Christians to strengthen the faith of young believers, to get them thinking through this whole area, doing some of the reading I'm referring to. We could also use it in presuppositional apologetics with non-Christians and the animal intelligence thing. I think is a good argument also. The disparity between human and animals can be turned into a pretty good argument for special creation of humans and imbuement with a soul. That's where all of this leads, is there has to be a soul, there has to be a mind that's distinct from our physical bodies. So, I get into this in this book, which we used to give away to non-Christians. The thought was, if I had a non-Christian friend and I was like, are you willing to read a book? And he's like, sure. What would I like to put in his hand? And so we tried to write to that level. I don't know, you can judge for yourself, but for churches, we give it away to anybody that wants a free book, we say, that visits one of our meetings. And if you're interested in a giveaway program, we make these available for $1.50, which is cheap enough to give away to people. And then you can bring up, so what did you think about the book? So if any of you are interested in that and can't afford one, I'll give you a copy if you want. Sorry about the question and answers. Wish we could have gone another hour. So much stuff. Very interesting. Let's turn to God and pray then. Lord, David is truly right that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We know this in our hearts. We can clearly see that we are absolutely in a category all of our own, and we have no one to thank but you for that. God, make us people who can explain this and make this case to the rest of the world, and also just as we reflect on the awesomeness that you've built into us, that it would draw us closer to you, God, and strengthen our faith. We pray for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.